Welcome to Whiskey Cask, the Cask Strength Podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 188 for February 22nd, 2009. Coming up in a few minutes.
Distillers are really just control freaks. They want to be able to control everything that they think makes a contribution to flavor and defend it from irregularity. So it's quite, being a distilling manager is a lot more defensive than people think it is.
That's veteran distiller Mike Nicholson, who served as distillery manager at Lagavulin and Royal Lochnagar, among other places. He'll share some of his 36 years in the whiskey business with us in a few minutes. First, though, let's look at the news. Grouse aren't usually found in India, but the Edrington Group is hoping to make the famous grouse blend a staple in India. Edrington is planning to expand its famous grouse portfolio there in hopes of claiming up to 20% of the imported whiskey market in India. The expansion will include a new version of the grouse, but Edrington executives haven't decided whether it will be the so-called black grouse peated version now sold in Europe or a snow grouse with a sweeter taste. Edrington's flagship single malt, the Macallan, now has more storage space on site at the distillery in Easter Elkies near Craigellachie. Two new warehouses have been completed at a cost of $14 million U.S. approximately. The warehouses will add storage capacity for 40,000 barrels of whiskey. Staying in Speyside for a moment, the finalists in this year's Spirit of Speyside Festival Whiskey Awards have been announced. The winners will be selected by those attending the festival's opening dinner on May 1st. There are three categories. For malts up to 12 years old, the finalists are the Glenfiddich 12 and Speyburn 12-year-olds. For malts 13 to 20 years old, the Glenlivet Nadura 16-year-old and the Aberlour 18-year-old are the finalists. And for those malts 21 years or older, the Glenfiddich 21-year-old and the Linkwood Portwood are the finalists. Again, this year's festival runs from May 1st through the 10th. You can hear more about it in my interview with Festival Director Ross Lewis in episode 182 from last month. Times are tight these days, and the folks at Malt Advocate magazine are trying to make Whiskey Fest a little more affordable. John Hansel and his team have announced a cut in ticket prices for Whiskey Fest Chicago on April 1st. General admission tickets are now $95. That's $20 off the regular price. And it includes a one-year subscription to Malt Advocate magazine. They're also cutting down the overall number of tickets that will be sold to cut down on overcrowding that night. There's a link for more details at the WhiskeyCast website. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Whiskey Live London is this coming Friday and Saturday, along with Dramfest 09 in Christchurch, New Zealand on Saturday and Sunday. I'll be at the Whiskey Classic in Morristown, New Jersey on March 5th. Tickets are still available. The U.S. chapter of the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society starts its spring series of tasting events on March 12th in Atlanta. Whiskey Live Belgium is March 13th through the 15th in Verviers. Woodford Reserve will host its second Bourbon Academy Class of the Year at the distillery in Versailles, Kentucky on March 21st. Jeff Topping and John McDougall of Wild Scotsman will host a tasting at Smith & Walensky's Steakhouse in Columbus, Ohio, March 26th. The Whiskies of the World Expo is March 28th in San Francisco, and Whiskey Live New York is March 30th. Those are just a few of the events coming up over the next several weeks. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask.
Hi there, my name's John Campbell, Distillery Manager at Laphroaig Distillery. Become a friend of Laphroaig. Claim your own square foot of Islay at laphroaig.com.
Mike Nicholson spent more than three decades working in distilleries all over Scotland. He retired a few years ago to British Columbia with his wife, and I caught up with him recently at the Victoria Whiskey Festival.
My father was a distiller, a malt distiller first, and then a grain distiller, and both of my grandfathers were too. So my mother, for instance, was brought up as a young child on the island of Islay, which can kind of sculpt anybody's personality.
Give me the CV here, because I know that you've worked at pretty much
almost every one of the major distilleries at some point during your career, right?
Well, it's a bit of an overstatement. I've worked at quite a lot of distilleries now. The ones I've actually managed were Glenkinchie, Blair Athol, Kalila, Lagavulin, and Royal Lochnagar. So there are some famous names in there, some not so.
But you also worked at a bunch of others along the way, too.
Yeah, yeah. These are the ones I managed. I was the good fortune to be employed by Diageo, who, when I joined the business, had 45 malt distilleries. So my kind of education, especially as a young man, was just terrific.
Tell me about it. How'd you get the education?
Well.
We know how you got the genetics for it, but how'd you get the education?
Okay. Well, the things are kind of were different back then. It was so long ago. But if you joined the corporation, showed aptitude and application, hung around for long enough, because there was actually an age requirement about when one could become a trainee distillery manager, you could more or less kind of blag your way in. Nowadays, life's a lot more sophisticated, organized, and complicated, so the kind of opportunities that people have to get into the distilling business now take a different form.
So let's go through it now. You got your start at which distillery, and then before you became a manager, where all did you work at?
Oh, boy. I'm going to get light soon. Well, I started as a young man in an analytical laboratory. So I got to analyze product from the distilleries and assess its quality. When I was successful enough to gain a place on their management training scheme, the first distillery I spent any time at was Glenord, which is in Rossshire. It's about 16 miles north of Inverness. After that, I had fleeting visits to other distilleries, usually to deputize for guys who are off on holiday and the manager's going away. Can you look after the place for a while? And my first appointment, official appointment, was Linkwood, just outside Elgin. Really interesting plant, because there's two distilleries there, one the original Linkwood and a new Linkwood built in the late 1970s. After that, I went to St. Magdalene, which is just outside Linlithgow. Now, regrettably, is a housing estate, but there you go. After that, where did I go? I went to Glenkinchie. There for 5 years. Glenkinchie is a nice lowland malt whiskey just outside Edinburgh. From there to Blair Athol, which is smack dab in the middle of Scotland, in the town of Pitlochry, which is a big tourist town. And the dram there is a large constituent part of the Bell's blend. From there to Kalila and Lagavulin. So I spent some time on the island of Islay. And latterly to the compact but bijou Royal Lochnagar, which is right next door to Balmoral, where the Queen goes on her holidays. But as my wife was always anxious to point out, you can't choose your neighbors.
What was it like moving from distillery to distillery? Because, as we all know, each distillery has its own individual character. How hard was it to absorb the character of the distillery that you went to?
Yeah, it's a good question, because a lot of people, I always think, imagine that when you arrive at a new place, you change everything. Well, that's about the last thing you do as a distillery manager. When you arrive, you get custody of a new distillery. The first thing you do, at least for the first year, is absolutely nothing. You just absorb what your legacy is, the working practices, how things are done, and how to defend that from outside interference. Because distillers are really just control freaks. They want to be able to control everything that they think makes a contribution to flavor and defend it from irregularity. So it's quite, being a distillery manager is a lot more defensive than people think it is.
And occasionally defending it from the marketing folks, right?
Marketing folks, well, I was usually fairly careful to have a clove of garlic about my person at all times.
What, in your mind, makes a good single malt?
Oh, when did you stop beating your wife, Mike? Would you like to ask me the question a different way?
What do you prefer in a single malt?
Ah, very different. Well, I'm a kind of old guy now, and I don't know if there's an age function involved in appreciating malt whiskey or not. I suspect for a lot of us there may be. I find, when I look back on my experience, that I now gravitate to heavier flavors. When I look at what I drink domestically with wine, it's about the same too. So I like big smoky things, but maybe not on my cornflakes. You know, a lot of what you drink is a kind of occasion driven. And another favorite story of mine is, you know, people habitually ask me questions like, well, what's the best way to drink it, Mike? No? And sometimes when I'm moved, I'll say, well, depending where you are, out of the bottle is sometimes good. And it's like, I tell them a story about, well, I've been out hiking all day, and it's wintertime. I just got off the hill, we're back in the car park, and it's dark, and we're just getting all our stuff off and into the car, and this guy goes into his car trunk and pulls out this bottle of X whiskey, and you take a hit out of that, and for that time, it's just perfect. Just hits the spot. You know? So it's kind of hard to give a definitive answer, but generally speaking, I'll drink a light whiskey before I've eaten. Afterwards, well, I'll reach for the big guns then.
How hard is it to balance your own personal tastes as a whiskey drinker with the needs of the distillery as a distillery manager?
Wow. It's easier than people might suspect, because the way, if you've had my experience, you view whiskey differently from, say, every man. Because to me, a whiskey is not a whiskey. It's a little creature that occasionally doesn't do what it's told. My personal preference of drinking really don't matter. I've been asked to look after this personality. So I'm driven just to make sure when I leave the plant and move on to another one, that the whiskey is in the same condition, if not marginally better, than when I arrived. So the focus is different. I focus on my charge, what I've been given custody of. What I choose to drink is just in another arena somehow, and they're not at cross purposes.
Now, we all know that a lot of the whiskey that comes out of the distilleries goes straight to the blenders and doesn't go into a single malt. But how do you make the cut? Or how do you decide what barrels go to the blenders and which ones you get held on to for single malt use?
I'm a little dismayed with your language about just going to the blenders.
Okay.
Although I spend a lot, I've made malt whiskey all my life, and I'm kind of passionate about it still, even though I'm kind of retired now. People need to understand that if it weren't for grain whiskey and blenders, I wouldn't have had a career.
Fair enough, yeah.
That what made malt whiskey popular was blended whiskey. Without blended whiskey, there would be no malt available. Nor can I get into invidious comparisons about malt versus blend. What one should be doing is comparing blended whiskies against each other and comparing malt whiskies against each other. Because the flavor range, even in blended whiskey, is bigger than most people think. As far as making whiskey is concerned, and whether its ultimate destination be a blend or a malt, has got very little to do with the distiller. What he's charged with is making that liquid taste the same all the time. Then a blender will dispatch a cask to contain that whiskey. It then goes into storage, and depending on the blender and the kind of cask he supplied the distiller with, that and the length of time it's going to spend in there, that will determine its final destination.
So the
is that not clear enough? Sorry.
No, so the cask may never get sampled before it goes, or it may just get routinely sampled with a bunch of others before the decision is made whether it goes to blending or whether it gets held back for single malt use.
A malt whiskey is produced in no different way, whether it's going to malt or blend. Malt whiskey can be sampled as often as you like. Most blenders don't have the requirement to do that because they have a track record. They know that if Nicholson can make Slagavulin taste the way it always has, that's one less thing to worry about. If they know that it matures well in American refills, then that's what they send to Lagavulin. And they know if these two criteria are correct and they leave it for 16 years, it'll be in seriously good shape. If they feel a requirement to go and sample it to check, then they will. But because a blender can be comfortable that there are constants in the equation, he doesn't necessarily need to double-check himself all the time.
Is the blender, and because I've talked to a number of blenders over the years, is the blender the distiller's best friend or his worst enemy?
All right, good. What a good question. That would, again, depend on who you're asking. Personally, I've kind of put myself out there, really, saying that without them and their efforts, there would be no long-lasting reputation for Scotch whiskey, and therefore the tenure of my job as a malt whiskey producer might have been shaky. But because the blenders constructed and then protected the reputation for the excellence of these products has led me to have just a great career. So they're kind of my friends. I hope there aren't too many of them listening to this show, though. I'm going to get some mail. Because I wasn't always polite to them, as I recall.
Okay, tell me your worst, tell me your best story, rather, about dealing with a blender.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I don't know if I've got a great kind of barrel of laugh stories, but I have to tell you that blenders are people as well, you know, contrary to what many people may believe. I have to tell you about the master blender for Johnny Walker, who is an ex-colleague of mine, a wonderful man. His name is Dr. Jim Beveridge. And you would expect him to, I don't know, you might have a preconception about what Dr. Beveridge might look like. He might be a large, imposing, and authoritative kind of man. Kind of man you might think might be used to barking instructions, perhaps. But no. A real gentle, mild-mannered fellow whose knowledge about the malt whiskey business is seemingly limitless. And his hobby is rearing exotic sheep. Would you believe that? That's a little farm, you know, on the edge of Loch Lomond, and he rears these really strange creatures. So, blenders are really interesting people. That one's a particular charmer, and the kind of guy that lives a double life.
Of all the whiskies you've worked with over the years, which one do you prefer the best?
I should point out to you that people in my position go to inordinate lengths to avoid answering any questions involving the word favorite. That's very hard because most of the whiskies I'm most fond of are the ones that I've made a contribution to. So you know the names already. They might not be the first whiskies on everybody's lips, but I have an association with them that's different from most people. You know that I gravitate to kind of heavy flavors. I'm not saying favorite, but if you'd ask me about another question about Lagavulin, I might remind you that it is a prince of whiskies.
One of the things that I've heard from people who collect whiskies and have drunk malt whiskies for many years is that there's a perception of a drop-off in quality, or in that whiskies that are made, the current generation of whiskeys that we're getting are perhaps not as good as what were produced, say, in the 60s and 70s. What's your perception on that?
Well, it takes a slightly different form from that. I get questions about, has the whiskey changed? And I usually reply with, I certainly hope so, madam, whoever it happens to be. But I answer that way because nobody gives me any time parameters. And people think that whiskey is a kind of static thing, and what we're drinking is what our grandfathers drank. And I'm not prepared to believe that, because I've seen in my 36 years in the business significant development in business practice and technique. So these practices are not introduced to make the whiskey better. They're introduced for two reasons. One is, first of all, consistency, and B, the ability to sustain that consistency. So I think if you measure over a lengthy period of time, yes, the whiskey has changed. Nobody really notices because they're kind of subtle, and the length of time that whiskey matures means that it's not an impactful change, but perhaps a gradual one. But in my time in the business, I've never seen anybody institute a practice that, to my mind, injured the product. I could only talk about my employer, but my experience is my experience. So, yes, I think they do change. Do I think it's got worse? No. I think it's got better.
What are you doing these days? Because you've retired, basically. You're moved out here to Western Canada now. What are you doing these days?
All right. Well, I'm trying to stay out of the snow, which was going pretty well until last December when we got 4 feet. But generally, I'm working on my wife's to-do list, trying to get my blues band booked, doing a little fishing, and chasing her on her motorcycle. We do travels to the Americas, that kind of thing. So having a great time.
You ever think about doing some distilling around this region?
Yes, there are some gentlemen who are fired with the idea of distilling on the island, and I can share with you the fact that my telephone has rung.
And we'll leave it at that for now.
Well, good luck to them.
If or when they persuade Mike to come out of retirement, I'll let you know. Finally, in the last episode, I asked for your help in coming up with a whiskey-related name for an Old English sheepdog puppy. I received probably about 80 suggestions through the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, email, and the Whiskey Magazine chat forum. Some of the suggestions, McKay, Malty, Chaser, Bootleg, and Cooper, which was one of my favorites. For the Aberlour lovers, there was a Booner, and for the Ardbeg fans, there was Oogie, Airy, and Corey, along with Ardbeg itself. The bourbon community was represented by Winkle, Woodford, Beam, Hancock, and Forrester. And last but not least, Sheep Dip. Thanks for the ideas. In the end, my hopes for a whiskey-related name were overruled, and Bristow has now joined the family. But in case you find yourself in a similar situation, I've posted all of the suggestions at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find links, the calendar of events, my whiskey ratings, the WhiskeyCast store, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com, and you can also sign up there for my Twitter feeds and the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and I'd love to hear from you. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2009, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.